your take on what's going on with Trump. And is that going to be consistent? Are they going to really stop sending weapons to Ukraine?
I do think so, Nima. I mean, you know, I'm sure that there are channels of contacts there and networks of mutual support that are still alive, but I think they're getting gradually and progressively shut down, because it doesn't make sense for the United States to continue pouring its assets into a project that's already failed. And right now, the United States is being asked to provide security guarantees to Ukraine, military support, financial support. It's all costs, with next to no upside for the U.S. So what's the point? I think that Trump and his administration were sincere when they said that they wish to move away from the post-World War II global order, you know, the rules-based global order, and to embrace multipolar integrations. And, you know, both the war on Iran in the Middle East and the war on the war on Russia through Ukraine are ultimately imperial wars. They are the wars of the rules-based global order, which wishes to impose their hegemony over the whole Eurasian landmass. They want to destroy regime change and partition Russia. They want to regime change Iran. This is the kind of thing that either you're with them or you're not with them. You know, it doesn't make sense to be with them a little bit, to continue to support Ukraine a little bit, to be hostile with Iran a little bit. You're either on one side of the divide or on the other side. And if I set aside the rhetoric, because the rhetoric is very confusing, you know, one day they say this, the next day they say that. But when I look at the outcome of what is going on, of the events and their results, it seems to me that the Trump team is consistent, and it's clear that they wish to extricate the United States from these globalist misadventures and to really embrace the multipolar integrations. So, you know, they want to negotiate with Iran, not even about the nuclear program. They don't want a regime change. They want to negotiate bigger things. You know, Iran has a lot of oil, as Trump said. So they probably wish to develop that potential. And, you know, what happened when, I think it was Hegseth that gave an interview about a week ago, and he was asked if, no, it was Witkoff, sorry, Witkoff gave an interview, and they asked him about whether the United States is going to seek further sanctions on Iran or if there's going to be a lifting of sanctions. And he generally expressed himself in favor of lifting the sanctions and easing them. And among other things, he said, this is a message to China. And the signal was, we are ready to make deals. We're ready to go beyond this role of policing everybody, imposing sanctions, punishing countries, forcing everybody to toe our line. And I think that this is what they're doing. That's, you know, when I set the rhetoric aside and I look at what they are doing, this is consistently the signal. Also, last week we had a piece of news which maybe went largely below the radar, but there was a unit set up under, I think, NSA, National Security Agency, that was tasked with kind of antagonizing Russia and increasing pressure on Russia in order to force them into negotiations, exploring strategies for that, including false flag attacks and all this. Well, Trump just dissolved this body. They sacked all the people that were on this committee, and they discontinued it. So, you know, that's another signal saying that we're done with Project Ukraine. You know, it's not, it's a lost cause. So we move on.
Since you've mentioned, I wanted to focus on Ukraine, but since you've mentioned the case of Iran, Alex, when Donald Trump with, he has decided to share Jeffrey Sachs' video and about Netanyahu, attacking Netanyahu, by the way, putting blame on Netanyahu about all these wars in the Middle East, endless wars of the United States. And he went to the Middle East. He didn't go to Israel somehow. Strange. It didn't happen in his first term. And with the case of, and we know what has happened during 12 days of war between Iran and Israel. We have, you look at the pictures, they don't let to any sort of information, that much of information coming out from Israel, coming out to the media. But from what we've learned from the pictures, from the videos that we've seen, you see the scenes look like Gaza. You know, Netanyahu coming from a position that they were going to destroy Iran, do regime change Iran, and right now in a position that he's not feeling good in Israel in terms of what's going against him. And Donald Trump comes out. For us, that I saw that Netanyahu, this sort of weakening of Netanyahu is somehow beneficial for Donald Trump. He can go and find, beat Netanyahu in that term, but it didn't happen on the scene. On the scene, you don't see that happen. He goes and support Netanyahu in Israel. It seems that somehow he feels a weakened Netanyahu, a defeated one, is better than any other option for him for the time being. What's your take on that? The way that he supported, he tried to force the judicial system of Israel in order to help Netanyahu.
So that's, I agree with you that that's difficult to explain. And so, you know, obviously we're going to have to speculate a little bit, but it seems to me that Donald Trump, I think that he kind of maneuvered Netanyahu where he wanted him. And that Netanyahu has maybe, you know, come around to at least overtly support Donald Trump. You know, they went with a big thank you to Donald Trump and all this. And so now if he's overthrown, if he gets impeached, then who knows what happens from there. You see, one interesting thing that happened during this 12-day war is that the Americans came, well, Trump came out and he said, we obliterated the Iranian nuclear program. We completely obliterated it. It is vaporized. It doesn't exist anymore. What has he done with this? He has removed the West's justification for war on Iran. Because, you know, they didn't really tell us that they want a regime change. They said, oh, we must remove the nuclear program because that's too dangerous and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, the public in the West thinks like, well, you know, the Iranian regime is so, so dangerous. They invade somebody every 300 years or so, right? So they cannot have nuclear weapons. So you have a pretext to act, you know. So if you bomb them, then people say like, okay, well, you know, it's for a good reason, I guess. It's illegal, it's immoral, it's wrong, but, you know, it's for the greater good, so that the Iranians don't get a nuclear bomb, because then they're just going to bomb us all because they're so horrible and hateful and medieval and irrational. So now you say, okay, the nuclear program is gone. It's gone. It's like vaporized. So now there's no more pretext for war. And Netanyahu immediately jumped on this because he needed the political boost. You know, he needed to show a victory, a major strategic victory over the big enemy, Iran. So he immediately bought into this whole Trump project of destroying Iran's nuclear program. And now if he stays there in power, then he's, I think that Trump kind of maneuvered him into accepting peace, into standing down, calling off further attacks on Iran, and now negotiating, having to negotiate peace with Hamas. If they remove Netanyahu, then we're back to square one, because whoever takes over next might say, no, the nuclear program was not destroyed. We have to go back to attacking Iran. And no peace, no peace in Gaza. We carry on bombing them and we carry on waging war till the end. So maybe in order to try to pursue peace, he prefers to be dealing with Netanyahu than to be dealing with the next unknown, whoever that might be. But I suspect that it's going to be somebody even more to the loony fringe than Netanyahu already is. You know, the messianic fanatics who don't even have a rational thought about the whole situation. They're just going to go all the way to Armageddon without stopping.
Alex, what we've learned during the war and in the aftermath of the war and IAEA, with the situation with IAEA, Iran has decided to cut all these talks, communications between Iran and IAEA. And we know that Palantir was part of this AI system within IAEA to help Israelis, intelligence and organizations, all of this. It's not just about Iran. It's about Russia, Iran, China, those countries that have nuclear program. It was a sign for all these countries that are somehow communicating in IAEA. How is that going to influence? Because it's not just about these people, it's about what's behind the scene, what's going on, what do they want from the nuclear programs in those countries? And that could put these countries in somehow in a vulnerable position. You remember the attack on nuclear bombers of Russia. These are not something, these are huge things. These countries are behaving rationally, logically. They're not reacting that much to understand. But if it was on the United States or any other, I don't know, Germany or other countries, they're going to react. But Russia was behaving rationally. Iran tried to calm down. How do you see IAEA and these organizations and the way the future of the communication between Russia, China, Iran, and all those countries that the West doesn't see them as friendly, as someone to work with, to collaborate with?
Well, I think that it's quite obvious that IAEA has been compromised and they have effectively taken advantage of Iran's compliance to help Iran's enemies undermine Iran, to target their program, to target their scientists, and to pass the necessary information to the Israelis, to Western intelligence services, in order to be able to target the vulnerable spots in Iran. So I think that the Iranians are fully in their right to throw IAEA out. And I think that, you know, this will force an overhaul, because this, you know, using IAEA in this way is also an attack not just on Iran, but it's an attack on the rule of international law. These agencies, in fact, serve as they serve a policing function. So they say, okay, you have to abide by these rules, so we're going to observe your compliance. Well, if the observation and policing becomes weaponized against you, then obviously you can't continue to comply, because it's directly to your detriment and to the benefit of your enemies. So I think that, you know, while I think that the Russians and the Chinese perfectly understand this, And I think that neither them nor the Iranians intend to undermine the rule of international law, because, you know, like without international law, we have chaos. We have potentially war of everybody on against everybody with no, you know, with no holds barred. You know, it would be chaos. But I think that Iran will demand major concessions in order to come back into those types of arrangements. And the concessions will be, well, okay, Israel's going to have to sign a non-proliferation treaty. IAEA inspectors are going to have to go there and see what's there. You know, what's how many warheads they have, what's at the Dimona, what's... So if we subject ourselves to an inspection regime, then Israel has to subject themselves to the same exact inspection regime as well. And then, you know, I think by now everybody understands that this whole mess with the Iran nuclear program is almost contrived. It's not real. They are pushing this line because they want to the regime change. But, you know, since we in the West support the rule of law and democracy and freedom and human rights, then we can't overtly say, well, yeah, we want to install the Shah in Tehran and we want to overthrow the current government of Iran, which is, you know, democratically elected. You like it or not, but that's a fact. So they have to harp on this nuclear program. But, you know, the whole world by now sees, okay, here's Libya, who gave up their nuclear program, and it got attacked. Muammar Gaddafi got overthrown, he got killed, and the country got completely destroyed. It went from being the most advanced country in Africa to being a failed state in just a few years. And then the contrast is North Korea, which didn't give up their nuclear program and which does have nuclear weapons. Well, nobody's daring to touch North Korea, right? And so I think it's you know, you have to take that into account. For Iran, they don't have a nuclear weapon. They have a fatwa against having a nuclear weapon, but they have made themselves a nuclear threshold state in order to be able to build a nuclear weapon in a short time, not because they're going to bomb anybody, because they can't, but to have a deterrent so that if their enemy decides to nuke them, they can nuke them back, so that their enemy says, like, okay, that option's off the table, we can't do that. It's a deterrent. That's the sole purpose that it serves is as a deterrent. And so I think that Iran, particularly in view of the precedents of Libya and North Korea, Iran is fully entitled to have that deterrent. And I think it's not right to demand them to give it up while demanding nothing of their enemy, you know? Curious? So you have two adversaries and you're putting all the pressure on one side to disarm, to give up their nuclear program, to give up their missile program. And at the same time, you're asking absolutely nothing of the other side. Well, you know, that doesn't work. That's not law. This is partisanship. This is taking sides. And again, you know, as always, the fault lines is the empire versus the rest of the world. So in effect, you're taking the side of the empire and the, you know, or i.e. the global, the rules-based global order. And so I think that Iranians are fully in their right to say, no, we will no longer comply with this as is today. And I think that the Russians and the Chinese perfectly understand the situation. So, you know, they're going to be generally supportive of Iran. And then they're going to apply pressure. Okay, so if you want Iran to comply with IAEA inspections, well, then we have to force Israel to do the same.
Yeah. Alex, do you feel that what has happened to Iran would somehow strengthen the relationship, the security and military relationship between Iran and Russia, How is that going to work for the two countries, and which are somehow negotiating with the United States? But those people who were some advocating to a better relationship with the United States are getting weaker as time goes by in those countries.
I think it will strengthen the relationship between Iran and Russia. I think that it was clear that Iran needs Russia and Russia needs Iran, you know, and now it became even clearer, because I know that in Iran, there's a, you know, like there's a part of the political class that is still very distrustful of the Russians. And then, you know, maybe there's a little bit of that mutual feeling on the other side as well. But, you know, it's very obvious why Russia needs Iran. And now it's much more clear why Iran also needs Russia. Because, you know, we're talking about a complete overhaul of the security architecture on the whole Eurasian continent. And Iran is practically the centerpiece of the security architecture of the West Asia or the Middle East. And we see how important that is now, especially that, you know, what was it in March, in less than 3 months ago, Azerbaijan got a new British military attaché, you know, who took office under a British embassy in Baku. And then all of a sudden, hey, look, you know, you have Azerbaijan beginning to antagonize Russia, and they begin to antagonize Iran all at the same time. So you see the British geopolitics is continuing in operation. And if you don't set up and cement a new security architecture, that's only a guarantee that it's going to be war, more and more and more war. They're always going to find a pretext, you know. So, you know, you can find some reason to go and antagonize the Russians and start to destabilize, you know, derail the friendly relations between Russia and the Azerbaijan, which they tried to cultivate in spite of all the difficulties. Well, you know, if you blow that relationship up, then immediately you're poisoning the relations between Russia and Turkey. Because, you know, Turkey and Azerbaijan have a common interest there. And ideally, they would like to connect territorial, you know, on that, how do you call that? That land bridge between Azerbaijan and Turkey. Zangezur corridor. Mm. So, you know, that could be the territorial connection between Turkey and Azerbaijan. So that's already like a potential crisis flashpoint. And then that's going to pull Turkey back into the globalist camp, where they already are because of Syria, you know, because the Turks are completely in bed with the British intelligence in Syria. So it's a big, complicated mess. And then obviously the globalist forces, and I don't think it's CIA as much as it is MI6 and Mossad, who are, you know, have very close cooperation with the, you know, Azerbaijanis, with their deep state. And
yeah, this is the corridor that you were talking about.
Yes. And so that's, you know, it's the Azerbaijan is already on bad terms with Armenia, and they've been in and out of wars for the last 30 years. And we still don't have now maybe we do have a solution to that conflict, because the Armenians merely yielded to Azerbaijan's territorial ambitions. But there's still this Zangezur corridor that Baku would very much like to control. And so that might come up sometimes in the near future, particularly if you have, because, okay, this has been the one of the major strategies of the MI6 to try to dominate West Asia has been working with the Turks, with the Turkish deep state, and of course with the Azerbaijanis, because they're also Turkic people, to what the British geopolitics has done for the past 200 years. They always promise concessions to regional powers. So if they want Turks to help them take over Syria, they'll take them like, oh, we'll help you against the Kurds, or we'll help you establish your kind of dominant position in among the Turkic people. And there's this project of Great Turania, you know, which goes from Turkey all the way almost to China, to Xinjiang province. And it's all these Turkic people, all the stans, you know, the Turkmenistans, the Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Azerbaijan. And then, you know, but for the Zangezur corridor connection to Turkey. So this could be the whole ginormous Great Turania, which, you know, maybe people like Aliyev or Erdogan would like to have in their legacy, that they united the Turkic people in the world and created this great political, economic entity. But then that completely derails the BRICS architecture. And not to mention that northern part of Iran is southern Azerbaijan, again populated by majority Turkic people. So you can always use separatist movements to destabilize Iran in this way. And obviously they're moving in that direction. So I think that if you're Russia and China, this is a sign that you really need to support Iran, because Iran is the antithesis of these Western schemes to destabilize the region. And, you know, I think that Russia has been largely successful in this sense, because the British... Okay, so the current head of MI6, Sir Richard Moore, used to be the ambassador, British ambassador to Turkey. And so this Great Turania was his assignment. And he, you know, he has become close friends with Erdogan, right? And he's been selling Erdogan on this Greater Turania project. And Erdogan has been very receptive. And he tried to co-opt Turkey into their war on Ukraine, on Russia and Ukraine. They wanted to bring Turkey as a Western ally in the proxy war against Russia and Ukraine. They wanted Turkey to support the West in Ukraine. And, you know, the Turks did a little bit, but not. And that was thanks to Russian diplomacy, because the Russians made sure, even though, you know, Turkey is not really an ally of Russia, but at least they're not an enemy. So the Russians brought Turkey out of the Western alliance, and the Turks chose not to join the alliance against Russia. So they're kind of in a limbo, half-half. But they're not, you know, the Brits are not going to stop trying. They brought Turkey into the Project Syria. So, you know, the Turks cultivated HTS together, and together with the Brits, they managed all these jihadi militaries and militias to overthrow Bashar al-Assad regime. And now, you know,
using pretty much... Turkic people, by the way.
Sorry?
Using the Turkic people, these...
Yes, exactly. But, you know, the Russians know that this is coming from them in the future. If they let this stand... Because Russians are very vulnerable to these jihadi terrorist groups that the West cultivates in Dagestan, in Chechnya, in Kazakhstan and elsewhere. I mean, okay, Kazakhstan is not in Russia, but I mean, you know, it's all along the soft underbelly of Russia, where they are at at risk of being infiltrated by these terrorist groups. So if they consolidate their power in the Middle East, in Syria, and start gaining ground, well, then, you know, they're like, as they incubated them in Idlib to attack Syria, they can now incubate them better in Syria to eventually attack Iran and to attack ultimately Russia as well. And then China as well through Xinjiang. So I think there's no question that the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians are aware of all this and that they need to counter it. Now, how dangerous is all this? I honestly don't know, but I feel that it has to be a bit less dangerous than Ukraine, because if it was, let's say, if that line of attack was more viable than Ukraine, then the West would have chosen that line of attack rather than Ukraine. But they didn't. They chose Ukraine. So that this means that this is their plan B or C or something else. You know, this is they're trying to stir the pot in Azerbaijan and Iran and Armenia and so forth, because they are running out of options. So this is, they're playing a weaker card, I think. But we'll find out. This new escalation of hostilities between Russia and Azerbaijan and Iran, this is relatively new. So it'll take time for us to see where it's going exactly.